Organized by a group of community activists, and I want to thank all of them. I hope I get the whole list, organizations and individuals. And those are Socialist Forum, the UIUC chapter of the Independent Media Center, the Living Wage Coalition, the UIUC History Department, and the UI Labor Education Program. And a special thanks to Ed Hertenstein, the director, and Martha Kelly, who helped out with the arrangements and could not be here today. I also want to thank Jermaine Light, Gene Vanderport, Belden Fields, David Johnson, Jim Barrett, Jenny Barrett, Ron Peters, the members of the panel, and our speaker, Adolph Reed. And welcome to the Labor Institute, and I hope we have a good day. Well, I was talking yesterday on the phone with a local reporter, and I was trying to explain this event, trying to explain that, yes, there are going to be speakers here, but it's also going to be a workshop in which participants are meant to leave with some concrete ideas about what to do about the situation in the labor movement, concrete ideas for action. And this guy was not sure about that, and he was sort of grasping for some sort of analogy, and he said to me, so it's like a think tank? So I thought, yeah, it's like a think tank. It's an appropriate comparison and one that would suit the man we're honoring today, Stan Weir, who was a labor educator, a longshoreman, an author, an activist, and somebody who thought a lot about workers and worker struggles. We're here to think about the consequences of the recent split in the AFL-CIO, to think about how we can build effective grassroots connections between local activists, and to think about how labor unions and social justice organizations might work together to create a better world for working people. Today we're in the midst of the worst split in the U.S. labor movement since the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations in the mid-1930s. That was in the middle of the Great Depression, and many people, of course, at that time thought, well, labor is done for if they split here. But as we know, the CIO went on to organize the mass production industries like automobiles, meatpacking, and steel that had always resisted unionization in the past. And the AFL actually grew after the split with the CIO. So rivalry between unions is not necessarily always a bad thing. It can result in more organizing. It can result in more unions and more elected officials and politicians who actually know why unions are a good thing and fight for working people. But other rivalries between unions have been much less productive. After the CIO expelled 11 left-wing unions in 1949, those unions faced raiding by their former partners. Powerful organizations like the Farm Equipment Union, the Food and Tobacco Workers of America, and others simply disappeared. Their members were absorbed into their rivals, but more often than not, their militant and dedicated leaders and organizers were lost to the labor movement, at least the formal labor movement. I want to offer another caution about comparing today's split to the split in the 30s with the CIO. The old AFL and CIO had something that we today really cannot expect: a federal government that accepted the idea of collective bargaining as legitimate. Even the hated Taft-Hartley reforms recognized the legitimacy of union representation. But things are much worse today, I would argue, especially in the last, say, 6 years or so. Today we're seeing an alliance between government and union-busting elites that reminds one of the late 19th century. I don't have to tell this audience that private and public employers use their lawyers to file endless challenges to union elections. Some of you in this room have been involved in endless challenges to union elections. I don't have to tell this audience that many private employers fire activist workers with impunity because workers' cases are tied up for years in the labor boards and the courts. I don't have to tell you that employers routinely renege on their pension commitments, that they use the threat of bankruptcy and relocation as bargaining tools, that they lock out workers and hire private paramilitary police to guard their property and harass union members and supporters. And I don't have to tell this audience that union membership as a percentage of the workforce is at an all-time low. Everyone knows the bleak reality. The question is, what are unions and their allies going to do about it? Our little think tank today is not going to solve all of these monumental problems. Not today, anyway. Maybe tomorrow. We'll get to work on that on Monday, I guess. But let's take some small steps in that direction. We're here today to figure out what we can do to move forward, to build solidarity around issues of real importance to working people. So, make yourself comfortable, get some coffee, enjoy the speakers, and let's get to work. And with that, I'd like to introduce Gene Vanderport, a man who needs no introduction. He'll take it from here.
Brothers and sisters, and if I could be so bold, comrades and friends, I want to talk a little bit about Stan Weir. He was a very special guy, but let me just start with this. Stoughton Lynn writes in a recent New Politics, he first met Stan in Danville, Illinois, 30 miles away, surrounded by young, eager activists. Well, you're looking at a couple of those not so young, but still, I hope, eager activists. Stan Weir was the labor education instructor here at the U of I from 1968 to 1975. What great years. Though never achieving a degree, he was a fantastic teacher. He was a charismatic leader and a prolific writer. He brought a passion to his work that is just unique. Years of hard organizing and political activism in the auto plants and on the docks gave him a perspective that we all learned from. And it was a straightforward message. The labor movement begins with the rank and file. It ends with the rank and file. Everything else is the extras. And that's what he taught us. He had an uncanny understanding of the emotions and the wisdom of the everyday worker who is always uncommon. He hated union bureaucracies. And he warned Mitchell and I, never become a staffer. And boy, was he right. He taught us to love union democracy and fight for that first and last. That's the bedrock of any real unionism. He taught us how to engage and empower people, one-on-one, small groups, and then in larger numbers. He taught us that a political social justice movement delivers for workers, and narrow parochialism does not. He taught us how to effectively deal with white supremacy and male supremacy. And he also taught us that real labor unity and real labor solidarity isn't a bunch of initials in a headquarters somewhere. It starts in your backyard. Stan helped us put out newspapers that workers could read in Danville. Stan helped us organize labor coalitions that were unheard of at that time, included folks inside the AFL-CIO, Independents, the IEA, many other groups. We were just in our 20s pulling these folks together, but they were receptive to the messages and acted accordingly. My favorite story was when Stan Weir took the independent lift truck builders. They were affiliated with nobody. Didn't like anybody. And nobody liked that. But they were still tough people. They made Hyster lift trucks. Stan took the stewards one weekend and said, aren't you guys getting tired of striking and not winning? You just keep walking around in circles. You're not getting anywhere. I got a tactic you may want to try. And so in 1974, there was a three-day sit-down strike at the Hyster plant in Danville. That hadn't happened in like 30-some years. So that was the kind of guy he was and kind of training he gave us. And most importantly, I guess, for those of us in the long haul of this movement, he gave us a vision of a democratic society that is not yet here, but is imminently possible. But let me bring you all up to date. The real test of a legacy is in its immediacy. So this brief story. If the split among the big unions fosters of fear and loathing, it's the fear and loathing of internecine union against union wars. We've all been through, many of us in here have been through them. I've been through them far too long. Probably spent the better part of my organizing career defending locals that already existed and trying to take locals from somebody else. It's not a happy scene. But recently, I think Stan would appreciate this. There's something happened here. happened right here. 3 weeks ago, IEA, Illinois Education Association leaders and staff, those of us in the staff union, found through an email that our leadership, the IEA leadership, had decided with great wisdom to raid a 38,000-person small local in Chicago called the Chicago Teachers Union. We found this to be reprehensible, ill-conceived, and just plain wrong. Jermaine Light, who is one of the people who put this forum together today, is one of those rank-and-file leaders. She calls up the state president of IEA and says, "What is wrong with you? If you don't have a no-rate agreement with the IFT, we're going to negotiate one ourselves." The following Monday, the staff union met in Bloomington, and a motion was made to condemn and oppose any rating, and also to re-engage the IFT in all the common actions we know we had to be in to protect, to get health care off the table and make it a right for everybody, to get public school funding the way it should be, to stop the kind of takeaways and bargaining that we've seen. But the cause is the same. The brothers and sisters, the cause is the same. The vote was unanimous in the staff union. As far as I know, it's the first time the 81st Airborne was marched up to a plane, and when they were told where they were going, the 81st said, "We're not going there." So we think that's a fundamental thing that's happened. Rank-and-file members, rank-and-file staffers said no to a war. You build the unity in your backyard. So it's that spirit that brings us here today, and that's the spirit of Stan Weir. He passed away a few years ago, but he definitely lives in this room today. And so with that, let me introduce to you the keynote speaker. This guy moves the dead when he speaks. He's a prolific writer in his own right, a consummate political activist, one of the founders and leaders of the Labor Party here in the United States. And for those of you who have not yet had the opportunity to hear him and see him, get to know him. He's a great man. I introduce to you Adolph Reed, Jr.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. How you doing? I'm not, I don't want to talk too much because I'd like to have conversation. And but what I would like to do is toss out a few themes and a couple provocations, and maybe we can talk about them for a bit. That have to do with where we are right now. I'm not going to try to handicap the outcome of the split in the AFL-CIO. I'm a political scientist, and what those of you who've been around political scientists know is that we work best at predicting what's already happened. I could give you like ironclad reasons that Woodrow Wilson that it was inevitable Woodrow Wilson won the presidential election in 1912. but what I would like to do is talk a little bit about the pickle that we're in and where our movement stands now. And of course, that's the context out of which the split emerged. I've been trying to think about this. I've been in New Orleans the whole week. Some of you may know that my family's from there, and I just took my mother back into the city for the first time Wednesday and got her situated and just flew back up here last night. So all this stuff is churning in my head at the same time. So I've been trying to figure out how I would actually start and whether it would be adequate, to come here and say, well, we're screwed and we've lost, or we're screwed and we're beaten. Thanks for having me. But that is where we are, and we all know that's where we are, and we don't need the litany to know that's where we are. And I think it's crucial, though, to pick up on Toby's comment on one of Toby's very important observations, that how this period differs from the 1930s, right, from the mid-1930s. I mean, some of you may have seen the op-ed piece that the labor historian Ruth Milkman wrote in the New York Times on the eve of the split, where she actually struck the comparison of 1935. And what what I found astounding was that she never mentioned politics anywhere in this. And by the way, FDR was in the White House, and there was a Congress that had just passed the Wagner Act, or just passing the Wagner Act. Oh, by the way, isn't that a little different from right now? But I'm not saying anything we don't know, but what, and obviously, I mean, this is also preaching to the choir to say that we got to figure out some way to get the hell out of this pickle, right? Because things are just getting worse and worse and worse. And, my view, our view in the Labour Party is that the only way to do it is to build a working class movement. Now, that's hardly newsworthy to anybody here, right? But how do we build a working class movement? Well, there are some things I think we need to recall, right? That the labor movement is the anchor to a working class movement. The trade union movement is the anchor to a working class movement. It's not the totality of a working class movement. And on that basis, I think what I'd like to do is just take the aerial photo lens up just a little bit to kind of look at what's, one perspective on what's happened to us. It's a generally pretty familiar history, but Toby also mentioned the expulsion of left unions from the AFL. That compact, or what a lot of liberals like to call the post-war social compact, what Nelson Lichtenstein has referred to as the collective bargaining regime, sort of combination of the carrots and the sticks that got imposed on working class politics, after World War II, that seemed to work reasonably well within its own parameters for people who were fortunate enough to belong to the privileged sector of growing industrial unions during that period, seemed to work reasonably well. What's been becoming clearer and clearer, though, for the last, or should have been becoming clearer and clearer for the last 25 years, is that that period wasn't really a truce. It wasn't really a compact. It was like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Treaty. And the problem is that one side was arming and the other side wasn't. And then the 70s rolled around, and the side that was armed just started rolling on a blitzkrieg, and we've been... Well, there's a phrase that comes to my mind, but I guess I can't really use it. But we've just been blindsided by it, right? Our side has been blindsided by it. And what often happens when you're hit by surprise like that, and, I see what I think of as young people in the room, which is anybody who's like 5 years younger than I am. For people under 50, to be a little charitable with this, the main political experience, that the only political experience that those people have had in their lives is defeat, right? They've got no history of being able to fight for anything, right? And it's the main experience of most of us in this room, is that we've spent most of our adult lives fighting, some of us all of our adult lives, fighting constantly to negotiate the best possible terms of surrender, right? And, I mean, that's what we've been doing. And meanwhile, the right has been kind of tightening its grip around first, the culture and the society, federal government, and the world, and establishing a regime that sort of cuts us off completely, that cuts off possibilities. Let me, just give one little illustration. I just happened to see a couple of nights ago on public television in New Orleans a panel of the chief elected officers of the eight parishes in that region. They call counties down there parishes. The mayor of New Orleans, the chief executives of St. Bernard Parish, St. Tammany Parish, all of them except Orleans Parish. The chief executive of Jefferson Parish, who some of you probably saw on the Tim Russert show, Aaron Broussard, who's crying about the nursing home deaths. He and the mayor of New Orleans are the only ones who are Democrats, right? And Jefferson Parish is a largely a Republican parish. That's where David Duke's state house seat was, and that's where his electoral base is. The other parishes are Republican. The elected officials are Republican. The chair of the St. Bernard Parish Council said that he's convinced that there is no such thing as FEMA, that there is no Federal Emergency Management Administration. And he wasn't joking. He wasn't being sarcastic. He said he thinks that they're just kind of scrambling now, trying to pretend that there is something, right? But there isn't, right? And each one of these guys, and they were all guys, was like solid, sharp, trenchant in his criticism of the way the federal government has a handle this. And even the no-bid contracts, right? I mean, they were all saying, look, you know, all they've done is they've given these four big contracts. They've privatized all this. The government, they privatized all this. And they've given these four big contracts to these big private contractors, and they insist on being paid before they do anything. And they're competing with one another. Nothing's happening. All right, so this goes on for close to an hour. And then we get to the section of the program where they're going to propose their bold recommendations for what ought to happen. They all said that, you know, they need to coordinate and, you know, get their own message together. Okay. And then the most they could come up with was tax cuts, property and income tax incentives, income tax incentives for employers and for workers to encourage them to move back into the city. They can't even imagine, right? Nobody can imagine that, you know, that there's a need for direct federal intervention on the scale of the WPA, right? That this is what you got to do to respond to something like that, and that it won't happen otherwise. Now, I know this might sound a little bit like, you know, special pleading. It might even sound a little bit like it's off the point. And some folks, I mean, I know there's a lot of solidarity in this room, but some people outside this room might think that I'm just trying to drain your tax dollars to, you know, rebuild my mama's house. But the fact is that the larger point here is that we've lost the capacity, right, generally, our members, our constituents, right, people whom we need to influence, right, people who ought to be part of us, have lost the capacity to imagine, right, that government can be used as a tool to make people's lives better and to provide some kind of social insurance. Part of the problem is, and again, this is not a criticism of the trade union movement. You know, we've done what we've had to do in the context of the rules that have hemmed us in, but part of the problem is I just finished reading this new book by David Harvey called The Brief History of Neoliberalism, which I'd recommend to everybody in the room. But what Harvey, you know, describes as this regime of embedded liberalism, right, that prevailed in the U.S. and in most of the West for the first 3 decades after World War II, you know, sort of made it possible, you know, in effect, I guess the kind of one way to put it is to sort of pay off enough constituencies with the proceeds of continuing economic growth that the U.S. realized because of its peculiar place in the world after the war, pay off enough constituencies to sort of keep things moving along pretty well, and corporations got the profits that they needed, this and the other. The problem with, and this is a problem with labor regulation, it's a problem with how we think about the relation between politics and identity, for instance, is that, like, whenever you create classes of beneficiaries, you create the opposite at the same time. Whenever you create a category of privileged workers, you create an industrial reserve army, you know, right underneath them, that's going to be there to undercut the concessions that you seem to make on the one side. And then what happened, what began to happen in the early 70s is that for a variety of reasons, corporations and employers, Carter administration, what, the second half of the Carter administration was in the forefront, you know, lest we start getting, you know, too nostalgic about Carter. You know, in a lot of ways, the Carter administration was the warm-up act for Reagan. And I hope there's not that much Clinton nostalgia out there, because I still remember welfare reform and NAFTA. But they decided that, you know, they got the go-ahead, that we were weak enough and could be made weak enough that they could come after us. And they've been coming after us ever since. Now, this also is not a new story that I'm laying out, but one thing I'd like for us to think about, and this is something I've just been kind of formulating for myself, and this is actually the first time I've had a chance to try it out on other people, so I appreciate you letting me be your guinea pig. I hope Stan would appreciate this as well. But the theme is when compromises come home to roost, right? And we've made these compromises that have largely been imposed on us, right? The various other movements, for instance, that ought to have been, and that a lot of us have always thought of as fundamentally working class movements or movements of the working class from the outset, like the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, have, because of this circumstance that they've evolved in, and because of the mix of carrots and sticks, all these movements have developed on a different basis, right? Part of this regime that a key feature of this regime that David Harvey calls embedded liberalism is that we could expect, and it's with Gene, that I appreciate the comments about going on staff, in this context. But we've come to expect that, like when Richard Nixon got elected, he made a lot of anti-civil rights, anti-labor noises. But we always knew we could go in and dicker with him, but we got OSHA from him, we got affirmative action from him. And it wasn't because Nixon's vision of the world was more like yours or mine than say Clinton. In fact, I'm sure that when they have their respective crises of conscience at 3 o'clock in the morning, go stare in a mirror, the vision that Bill Clinton would want to see is probably a lot closer to us than the vision of that Richard Nixon would want to see, because for one thing, most of us wouldn't be in Richard Nixon's vision, right? His vision of a happy world, one that didn't have us in it. But the difference was that there were social forces in motion and our movements were strong enough, right, that Nixon just couldn't toss us overboard and he felt he had to respond. Well, but this dance developed, right? So we came to understand, I saw this a lot in the civil rights movement too, the legacies of the civil rights movement. We came to understand there'd be some tough talk, but there was always room to negotiate. You come back in the door and cut a deal, and they threaten to shut the plant down entirely, but then you come in and you sort of negotiate a smaller permanent reduction in the workforce, and then of course you get the call out of victory, right? It's like right. My good friend Paul Wellstone used to say, the right wing proposes a really terrible plan, and then the Democrats come back with a not quite so terrible plan, and then that passes, and then we all clap and call that a victory. But we got something worse than we had before. But anyway, so what's happened, of course, is that the right, and we saw this first with the Reagan administration, and have seen it more and more bluntly ever since. They just don't negotiate anymore, and they know they don't have to. And employers, again, this would certainly be preaching to the choir. It's clear that employers know that they don't have to. And it's no kind of employer. Right? I just saw in the New York Times this morning that Radio City Music Hall had made a magnanimous gesture of hiring a bunch of Louisiana musicians to work through the Christmas season. And they were going to pay them $1,600 a week each and pay all their expenses. But then the musicians found out that, I think it's local 8802 is on strike. Right. Yeah, local 802 is on strike, so they were going to import them as scabs, right? There have been other cases of that, less dramatic because they weren't with musicians, but they've been trying to import evacuees from Texas, to scab in California, right? The same kind of thing here. So the bottom line is, that the other side isn't really giving up anything but bubblegum and hard times, as my friends used to say in high school, and they're always fresh out of bubblegum. So, but here's the problem, right? I mean, here's a problem I'd like to see us grapple with among the many other problems we have to grapple with over the course of the day as we approach this as people who are trying to build a movement, to sustain and build a movement, is that one of the less widely recognized features of this embedded liberalism regime or its aftermath is it you know, we've what activists are has become something different, right? For a number of years, since early 80s, I've been sort of complaining about the transformation in the notion of the activist as organizer to the activist as advocate. But I think there's something else. I think there's maybe a crisper way to put it. And it's more like the NGOization of the movement, as another friend of mine has described it, or the idea of the activist, the notion of the career activist. You know, our national office is in D.C., and now that I'm living in Philadelphia, I spend a lot more time there and sort of interacting with folks like that, and just kind of underscores it. That career activists, there's a way that you can be a career activist and not ever be concerned about winning or losing, because you've got a toolkit of stuff that you do, and you do it, and your job is to do it, and you do it no matter what. So, for instance, you know, we've got, you know, I mean, we all know, you know, the sort of jobs of justice story, right? I mean, you know, it does great, great work, but there's also like a way that union staff leave the office and go to demonstrations. And then they come back to the office and they do their other work. And then when an election rolls around, we just sort of all go out and work our knuckles to the bone to you know, there are a lot of different analogies. I can't, you know, we go back and forth on this. I can't decide whether battered spouse or 2 a.m. booty call or what best describes the way that the Democratic Party thinks of us. But it's something like one of them. Anyway, I suppose that's neither here nor there. But it somehow doesn't matter, right? Like, it doesn't matter that the Democrats, for instance, have nominated the same sort of borderline anti-labor presidential candidate since Dukakis just over and over and over again, right? I mean, like, it doesn't matter that we can turn out 150, 250, 300,000 people for a demonstration in that follows the permit regime where to be able to demonstrate, you've got to promise that you won't disrupt anything and you won't let anybody see you, right? So then what happens is we compensate by evolving an internal demonstration culture that's all about kind of looking inward. So then we get the kids with the drums and the turtles, you know, and stuff like that, because we have to keep ourselves entertained because, you know, because the demonstration has become primarily an activity that affirms the commitment and inspires the people participating in the demonstration, which is fine. But the problem is that we continue to pretend that it's something else, right? And I think that's what this, you know, that's a problem of the persistence, right, of the practices that were associated with this embedded liberalism that don't work anymore, right? They're not effective, but we've got our own stratum of people inside the movement, our own job classifications inside the movement that are about performing those practices. And it doesn't really matter whether they're effective. And there are all kinds of narratives that we can construct about, you know, if we keep doing enough of the same things over and over again, then maybe eventually they'll spark something, or people will wake up, or there'll be some kind of apocalyptic moment, or, you know, the real leaders of the working class are going to emerge, right, or something like that. But I think the challenge for us is to try to figure out, it is to read politics back into our movement building, to read politics back into the workers' movement, back into the working class movement, back into the labor movement. And I think a part of that challenge is to try to seize the political agenda by laying out what it is that we actually want and trying to fight for that, right? I mean, you know, Mark Dudzik, you know, the Labour Party's national organizer, had a really nice post-election analysis where he strikes this, what I thought was a really moving image, of thousands of laid-off steelworkers, you know, going around beating the bushes for a candidate who never voted against the trade agreement. Right, for and you know, committed single-payer healthcare activists out fighting to elect somebody who had this sort of bizarre, impossibly expensive, thoroughly convoluted plan that that on his own estimation would still leave half the uninsured uninsured. Why do we fight for that? You know, we might have to settle for that, but why do we fight for that? It kind of strikes me. I mean, there's such a radical disjunction, and I'll shut up in a minute, but there's such a radical disjunction between, you know, the way that we pursue our work as trade unionists and the way that we pursue our politics, that it's almost like two different people are doing the same thing. Two different institutions are doing the same thing, right? I mean, who's ever gone into a contract negotiation by saying, okay, I know you only want to give me this, and I'm prepared to give you like a 50-cent an hour wage reduction just to open the negotiations. Right? Anybody ever done that? I know you're having trouble meeting ends meet around healthcare, so we propose, right, you know, to increase the co-pays. No? Well, then why the hell do we do that with the Democrats all the time, for God's sake? I'm just curious. I mean, maybe somebody could tell me. But beyond that, or rather in addition to that, we need to kind of fight to try to take back the conceptual ground around politics in the country. And again, I think this is another instance of this problem of compromises coming home to roost. That it's been convenient for a lot of us in this room, to probably all of us in this room, you know, over the years, to make some concessions to a narrative that goes, there are economic issues and there are social issues. And we can unite the working class around economic issues. I know there were some people at our founding convention where we had a big fight over abortion, and in the committee meetings where we had the fight, there was an argument that reproductive rights, you know, was not a working class issue. It was not an economic issue. And I think, thankfully, the position that prevailed, and prevailed because it was persuasive, was that, of course, it's an economic issue and a worker rights issue. Right? I mean, what right's more fundamental than the right to control your own body, right? And as an economic issue, well, you know, I mean, you know, only if you think there's no connection between cost and pregnancy, then you know, you can imagine it's not an economic issue. But we need to find ways to stop giving the ground that we've been giving. And I mean, like the rhetorical ground, right? That there is no clear, you know, distinction between something we call economic issues and something we call social issues. And in fact, while it seemed convenient for us, and you know, I know why we've all done it. I've done it myself, and I've done it for the same reasons, right? It helps us work around a potential source of division within our own ranks. Problem is, people on the other side, well, yeah, they are stupid. I mean, they're stupid in a lot of ways, but they got a lot of money, and there's a lot of them who can spend a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, how to do stuff until they get it right, or right in a way that it works. And everything that we skirt, that, you know, that we try to tip around like that without addressing, they will take and use against us. They've taken the language of family, and they own that. And no matter how hard, you know, stuff that comes out of the AFL-CIO in D.C. is kind of baffling to me, because everything has got, you know, they got 12 different groups and programs that have the same name, right? It's like, you know, the working families, this, that, and the other. What about if we just called working class? What if we just described ourselves as the working class or as workers, and talk to other people as workers, right? You know, I think that the working families rhetoric sounds kind of good, I guess, in some ways, you know, like apple pie, but it also gives ground to a big compromise that the Clinton administration pushed on us around the welfare reform stuff, where the idea is that you count if you're in a family. All right, see, but if I'm not in a family, then, well, what am I? You know, I mean, what, do I not have rights? Do I not count, right? You know, like if I'm, you know, single, disconnected worker, right? I mean, so while it seems like it's a mindset that sort of builds a solidarity, I think it's just as likely to be one that undercuts a solidarity, not to mention the fact that the right wing will just always say, well, but you know, they're just trying to pretend to be something that they're not. right? Because then, you know, progressives, you know, not so much, you know, less of the labor movement, but then, you know, progressives will sort of get into, well, family doesn't mean necessarily patriarchal, father-dominated. Family can mean any group of people living in the same roof. And, you know, like, then you've lost momentum, and, you know, they just say, you see, they're just trying to trick you, right? Because what they are is really sleazy secular humanists anyway, trying to pretend about something else. To wit, we are, we as a Labour Party are on the verge of undertaking our first actual electoral campaign for office in South Carolina. One of the Charleston Five from ILA Local 1422 has declared his intention to run on a Labour Party ticket against a Republican, I hope I can say this word, asshole. There's just no other way to describe this guy. If it offends anybody, I'm sorry, but it's a description, not that. John Graham Altman, who is one of the biggest flamers in the South Carolina state legislature, which is, you know, that's like being Michael Jordan, basically. But, you know, to win that title. What's happened is, even before Leonard announced, the Republicans have decided to tie the 2006 state elections to a constitutional amendment, to a ballot initiative for constitutional amendment that will prohibit gay marriage and civil unions. Now, these are already prohibited by law, so the constitutional amendment is unnecessary, right? It, you know, from their point of view, like, it's only about drawing a line in the dirt, right, to try to divide progressives. And this is something we've got to figure out how to deal with. I mean, obviously, obviously Leonard Riley is opposed to that amendment. But we can't, and I don't know how the campaign's going to do it ultimately, because ultimately the campaign makes the decision. My argument has been that we can't, that it's not enough to say, we got to focus on what unites us, and not what divides us, or that this isn't a real issue. This detracts us from the real issues, because it is a real issue, right? It's a real issue on both sides, and we've got to find some way to do that. And frankly, you know, I'd be interested to hear what you guys have to tell me, right, how to grapple with. You know, with an issue like this. But anyway, you know what? I feel like I've gone on for way too long, and I'm rambling, and I hope I've put out enough, I've laid out enough stuff out there we can talk about for a little bit. And is that, yeah, we have some time to do it?
Yeah, you want to take some questions?
Yeah. Thank you. Questions? Oh, one more thing I want to say. I meant to say this at the beginning. I'm really very happy to be here. I did say that, but also to look out and see old friends from Chicago and from elsewhere in the area, some even from New Haven and Chicago. I'm really glad to be back, and I'm still sad I ever left. Whenever I see you guys, I wish I could you move back out here. But questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm glad. Yeah, I'm glad you put that issue out there. I mean, I mean, obviously you're right. I mean, and we in the academy. I mean, especially in political science. Although it may be that academic disciplines are like what my father used to say about state legislatures, that the worst one in the country is the one that's presiding in the state where you are at the moment, and it might just be that political science seems to be especially hideous because that's the one I'm in. But then I remember, well, no, there's always economics. So it could be worse. But I mean, yeah, no, I mean, in our job, right, like in our profession, I don't know about you, but I feel choked up to my eyeballs by the crap, right? I mean, by the way, I'm chairing a search for an American politics job now, and it's just breathtaking just how narrow and narcissistically narrow and small and petty and pointless. So I'm not singing opera aises, right? And I don't advise bright students who want to make the world a better place to go to graduate school. No, see, it's not so much the job description, right? I mean, it's not so much. Yeah, I mean, like we all want to be career activists, basically. I mean, all of us who were drawn into the movement. I did that before I went to graduate school. But we were all of us who were drawn into the movement work. Wanted to do that, for that to be our lives. I think that what's happened is that as the structures, but also as between the NGOs, and the union bureaucrats, I take the union bureaucrats any day of the week. But and I'm on the board of Public Citizen, which is one of the best NGOs, and they do good work. But see, here's a part of the problem. I'll take the Public Citizen example. What they mainly do is lobby and litigate, right? And both those are activities that assume at least a neutral, if not sympathetic, ear in the courts and in Congress. Well, once you lose that, then you kind of lost a rudder, right? And you need to try to figure out a way to develop a different kind of practice. What they've been doing at Public Citizen is trying to go out and create a grassroots base, right, to bring pressure, because people are, at least are smart enough to recognize that if you want to, to see the way the wind's blowing. But the problem isn't working for NGOs as working for NGOs, but the problem is getting entrenched, right? It's like class analysis, ultimately, right? I mean, in the sense that you are what you do. I mean, like you get entrenched in living a certain way. Those of us who've been in the academy or in NGOs, or as trade union officials, right? Have settled into a modus vivendi, right? Into a way of life. We have places where you go to drink coffee. You've got shops that you go to. You've got people that you associate with. You've got worlds and social networks, right? That reinforce and reproduce a particular kind of practice and a particular kind of view of the world. It's also the case that in these other organizations, in these NGOs, there are imperatives that come from above, right, about what material interests they're ultimately connected to, right? I mean, just as there's the account in the trade union movement of the tension between the rank and file activists and the ossified bureaucrats who I will reiterate, I think, get a bad rap. There's also a tension in those NGOs about street level functionaries and institutionalized leadership that's dependent on foundation grants. And ultimately, if they're international, like the IMF and the World Bank. See, because to whom are those agencies accountable, ultimately, right? And they often have the appearance of accountability because they got people out there on the streets, in the grounds, taking bags of groceries or whatever. But nobody elects them, which is why I would still, at the end of the day, prefer any trade union bureaucrat from the most corrupt union that we can think of. Wait, are you volunteering as being from the most corrupt union you can think of? Well, Okay, well, look, I'm not here to fight with them, to fight against them or to fight for them. But anyway, I guess the long and the short of it is that it's not so much what you do, but the way you do it and where you think you're going. And I think that there are imperatives, right, that sort of drive this kind of NGO activity that I want to challenge, and I want to challenge precisely because they're historically inappropriate at this point. Yeah, James? Yeah, okay. Oh, no, not 50, the last 20, to 25. Oh, look, I just, drove from New Orleans to Jackson, Mississippi, and was thinking about a lot of those victories all the way up, at every road sign I passed. Right, yeah. Ethan? They're historically inappropriate at this point. Yeah, James? Yeah, okay. Oh, no, not 50, the last 20 to 25. Oh, look, I just, drove from New Orleans to Jackson, Mississippi, and was thinking about a lot of those victories all the way up, at every road sign I passed. Right, yeah. Ethan?
Yeah. I'd like you to address another imperative, which is right in the middle of the whole question of the split and what characterizes the NGOs and the nonprofits, which is money. That is, I think that what freaks Sweeney out is that he's going to lose a chunk of change. And I think that what you find in the culture of nonprofits and NGOs is fierce competition over funding. The money's not coming from anywhere except angels. And unless you want to, hook up with Soros forever, which if you can arrange it, it's a sweet racket, but there is no money coming in. And they're completely consumed with fundraising. That's their idea of actual base building in most cases.
Did everybody hear the point?
No.
Yeah, that a key factor about the NGO stuff is the role of money, and that especially now there are no sources of money unless you can, go on the Soros tit forever, and often what they think of as a base building is a part of constant fundraising, and yeah, I mean that's true. I mean I'll revert to the public citizen case again. I mean they're facing possible staff layoffs now. The staff union just won a recognition election last year, and there may be an internal fight around that now, too. So that's exactly right. And the fact that you need the money, there are material forces that work behind our own backs. And the wise man once said, in effect, that ideology is precisely that thing that harmonizes whatever principles you want to have and what gets you paid, right? So it's inevitable that there'd be a creep, right? There'd be especially, and frankly, I think a lot of times people cross themselves and say democracy because they don't have anything better to say, but that's especially that's especially likely to happen if there's no democratic accountability, right? And the thing about being membership-based organizations, right, where you have real people with real names and addresses, who then therefore have the power to say, wait a minute, you can't say that in my name, imposes a political discipline, right, and a principle, and that you can't get otherwise. And yeah, and look, I'm still enough of a guilt-ridden Catholic boy, right, that I don't want to be unaccountable in that way. You know what I mean? I mean, because I don't trust, my inherent ability, right, to maintain, the proper balance of to understand that, well, to feel comfortable that this compromise is a compromise that really has to be made, and it's not just a compromise that has to be made to help me keep my salary, right? You know, I don't. So that's why we need the accountability, which is a core problem with the NGOs.
If we could, there's time after lunch for more questions, and I don't want to preclude the panel.
Absolutely not.
So unless there's a rebellion for the floor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was really great. Thank you.